listening to Harrismith Radio. Hey there, I'm your host, Wayne McPhail. This episode takes us on an Arctic journey where we explore the life and words of a remarkable Canadian children's author and storyteller, Michael Cusigak. Next, the story of how thousands of farmers across the country have assisted the Canada Food Bank to ensure food security for all Canadians and help defeat hunger, even in the darkest times. By the way, if you want to read Harrismith Magazine instead of listen to it, you can subscribe to the print version online at harrismithmag.com. And you can find Harrismith Magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. But for now, settle in for the next half hour of Harrismith Radio. Michael Cusigak grew up in Repulse Bay, almost a stone's throw from the Arctic Circle. As a child, he lived a traditional Inuit life, traveling the tundra snow and sea ice of Hudson Bay with his extended family and hearing from his grandmother and other elders the stories of his people. Michael is one of the first Inuit to write those stories down in English and share them in books and in person with thousands of Canadian children and adults. I had the pleasure of speaking with Michael about his life and the power of stories. Here's our conversation.
My name is Michael Cusigak. I am an Inuk from originally from Repulse Bay, or a place we call Nauyat, up at the north end of Hudson Bay. I moved to Rankin Inlet when I was 12 years old, and now we are in Manitoba.
Right. So I want to go back to your early days, Michael. You mentioned something in some of your writing where you said, a long time ago, it is said there was a little boy, and that's the way your grandmother started a lot of her stories. So I want to start this interview that way and say, a long time ago, it is said there was a little boy. There's a little boy named Michael. Tell me about that little boy named Michael.
The stories always start, type sumanigo, which means a long time ago. It is said there was a little boy whose name was Avaluk. He was born at a little point of land called Cape Fullerton, which we call Katiktelik. There was a little sod hut on the beach, and the sod hut belonged to my father's friend Autut, and that's where I was born.
Right.
And it was at the end of April, and immediately after I was born, we continued on by dog sled, of course. That was in 1948. And we ended up in a place we've always called Nauyat, although it has another name, Ivilik, which means a place where there are walrus. And Nauyat actually means seagulls. It's got seagulls because there are big cliffs there where seagulls come to nest every summer. And it is up at the north end of Hudson Bay, right on the Arctic Circle.
I'm looking at it on a map right now, and you could sort of walk into the Arctic Circle almost up there.
Yeah. Actually, somebody, probably the community, built this arch where you walk through it, and you can say you walk across the Arctic Circle.
Wow. So what did your parents do? You said they were in a sod hut. So how were they making their living? How were they feeding themselves?
This was in 1948, and nobody had a job. Like, you know, we didn't live, you know, anything like the modern day where we depend on money. People didn't have to actually work because we were nomadic people and we lived off the land. We hunted and we fished, and that's the way we lived.
Reading some of your stories, I get the impression that was a very difficult life and a life that really required people to be extremely intelligent about the environment and really read it well, right?
Well, I don't know that it was so difficult because we had been living that lifestyle for, I have read, anywhere up to 20,000 years. So, you know, a lot of people say we survived, but we didn't actually survive. We lived, you know. It was very incredible lifestyle, the way I remember it. We spent a lot of time hunting seals, mostly because we depended on seals for food, and we depended on seals for the oil or the fat that we used to heat our igloos with in the winter. You know, when you think about it, I would say it was really quite a comfortable lifestyle, you know, as long as there was a lot of game around. You know, we lived actually very well, and it was very peaceful, and, Yeah, it was great.
When you were born, was your grandmother living with you at that time?
I remember my grandmother very little because she died when I was probably around 5 years old. But she was the very first person I remember telling these traditional stories that I tell today when I travel around. You know, we lived as a family group, especially in the winter, you know, because the winters were the hardest. So we tended to travel together with my grandparents and my mother, my father, my grandparents, and me. I was the oldest in the family. And so we traveled, you know, with my mother's parents and a lot of my aunts and uncles. And we mostly spent our winters out on the sea ice because that's where all the seals were that we lived off of. And we had to feed our dogs very well because we depended on them. And so we spent a lot of time out at sea. And we hunted, you know, whales, walruses, and we fished for Arctic char. So we spent a lot of time out on the sea ice. I would say we spent more time on the sea ice than we actually did on land, because we would go ashore probably sometime at the end of June, the beginning of July, when the ice was just starting to get too rotten to travel on. And then we'd, you know, make our way to the land.
Right. And as you pointed out in Promise is a Promise, you didn't go down to the sea ice as a kid by yourself, right? Or at least you weren't supposed to, right?
Not in the spring. Hudson Bay is a sea, so it has tides that go up and down. And in some places, you know, the tides are really quite high, like, you know, 12, 14 feet. So in the winter, the ice freezes, or the sea freezes. And we end up with ice that is, I think, it goes down to around 6 feet thick. But it is still attached to the land, you know. So when the tides go up and down, you know, all the ice along the shore gets all broken up and all jumbled up. And, you know, it goes up and down with the tides. And so in the springtime, when the ice stops forming, you know, all that ice, all the broken pieces of ice get smaller and smaller. And in the springtime, it's a lot of fun to jump, you know, from one ice floe to another. So, you know, it was really quite dangerous for at least little kids anyway to be down there. So we were not allowed to go down there, but we did anyway.
Right. You know? Of course. So, you were a little kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that I wanted to talk about that, because that really that story, because I know your mother and probably your grandmother told you a story about sea trolls who would come out that didn't have kids themselves and grab kids that were by themselves on the sea ice in the spring and take them underwater. That story, which became A Promise is a Promise, that was your first book, right?
Yeah. Ever since I was a little tiny kid, I heard about these creatures that live under the sea ice, or they're sea creatures. And people used to say, you know, the older people, my mom and my grandparents used to tell me about these creatures that live down there, and they wear these big amouts, you know, the coats that are made of loon skins. And if you go down there, they'll take you, they'll amok you, you know. Amok means to put somebody on your back. They will amok you, and they'll take you down under the sea ice, and they'll never bring you back. So we're always scared of those creatures. And I think it was sometime around 1986, I had these three boys, and they always wanted to be read to at night, you know, when I put them to bed. And one night I told them a story, you know, we put the books away, and I told them a story about when I was a little kid, we used to go and play out on the sea ice. And one night we were fishing down on the sea ice, and you know, these bubbles started to come up, and somebody yelled, "Kalupiluit!" And we all got scared, and we ran off to the, you know, we dropped everything and we ran back to shore. And I told them, my boys, this story, and they said, "Dad, why don't you write it down?" And so I wrote it down, and when I read it to them, they said, "Dad, it is really scary. Why don't you have it made into a book?" I think it was about that time that Robert Munsch had been up in Rankin Inlet. We were living in Rankin Inlet. And he had been up there and with his daughter, Julie. So they knew about writing, you know, and they said, "Dad, why don't you write it down?" And So I wrote it down and I submitted it to Panic Press, which was the publisher that published Robert Munsch. And of course, I immediately got a letter that said, you know, we can't publish your story. And I said, sure, okay, that's fine, because I just wrote it for my kids anyway. But they showed it to Robert Munsch. And one day he called me and he said, Michael, I read your story and I like it very much. Would you like to work on it together? I said, sure. And why don't you rewrite it and send it up and, you know, send it back? We had to send this thing back and forth by post, you know, Canada Post. And it took a very long time, you know. So I get it back and I would rewrite it and I'd send it back to him and he would rewrite it, send it back. And when we were happy with it, it was published in 1988 by Ant Press.
Yeah, it's a lovely book.
Thank you.
And that was the beginning of your writing career. And that was unusual at that time for someone from Rankin Inlet, from the almost into the Arctic Circle, to actually start writing down these stories, right?
I had read a book by a guy named Marcusi, and he had written a book, I think it was The Harpoon of the Hunter, and it was published by some university press, and that was the very first book that was aimed at children that I could, you know, I had ever found. And so A Promise to Promise, was one of the very first books, I think, that's actually made for children.
So what made you, apart from the success of A Promise is a Promise, that could have been a one-off, why did you decide to go into that as a career?
Well, I, you know, sent the manuscript in, and well, Bob and I did. I got a letter from them saying, you know, we need a paragraph for the back of the book. I wrote a paragraph that actually ended up being 3 pages long, and because I didn't know what they wanted, so I just wrote a little long paragraph about what it was like to grow up as a kid, you know, up in the, it was called the Northwest Territories at that time. I got a letter back from them, and they said, we loved your 3 pages. Can you write 30 more? So they were looking for a 30-page autobiography. I started to write, but I never finished that autobiography. But in my autobiography, I came up with a little story about Christmas when these trees arrived in Repulse Bay. And, of course, Repulse Bay is tundra country, and there are no trees there because the permafrost is, you know, only a foot underground. So, and I wrote a little story about them, and I called it Baseball Bats for Christmas. And when that story was published by Anik Press, I decided, you know, there are more stories. You know, we were always told, like we were told about these creatures that lived under the sea. And there were stories about these little creatures that live out on the tundra, and they're called Iyagai. They are hide-and-seek creatures, and they love to play hide-and-seek. The only problem is, if they help you hide, no one will ever find you again. So I wrote a story called Hide and Sneak, and that became the next book. And then, of course, I have to continue on from there. And in 1992, I gave up my job at the government of the Northwest Territories to take up writing full-time.
That's a fantastic story. And I want to go back to some of the creatures, because one of the things I was fascinated about was one of the stories your grandmother told you, or a lot of the stories that your grandmother told you, featured an old guy, Kavivyok, is that how you say it?
Kavivyok.
Yeah. And what I found really interesting about him being not only sort of the oldest man in the earth, and when his whole body turns to stone and his heart stops, that's the end of the world. But you also found someone from Finland who recognized that word. Can you talk a bit about that?
We grew up with this character. In the first story, he traveled. He paddled his kayak across the ocean and ended up on the other side. And when he got there, he got homesick. So he started traveling and trying to find his way home. While he was traveling, he had some incredible adventures. He traveled through Baffin Island, where, you know, he had to go through the mountain passes because there are huge mountains on Baffin Island, and he had to go through a mountain pass. And every time he tried to go through a mountain pass, the pass would close. And so one day he decided to see if he could run through the pass before it closed. And there's a story about him, you know, running through the pass, and he made it to the other side of the pass, but, you know, the mountain closed and it caught the tail of his coat. And they say that, you know, the tail of his coat is still there and you can still find it somewhere. And so there are all kinds of these stories that are set in different places all across the North. And Kivyat stories are told actually right across the North, I'm sure from Siberia too. And they're told in Alaska, they're told all across Northern Canada. I was telling stories about him in Toronto at the Harbourfront Theatre in Toronto. And when I was finished, this guy came up, this blonde guy, and he said, "That's a very interesting word." And I said, "What word is that?" He said, "Kivio." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "We have a word just like that." And I said, I asked him where he was from, and he said, "Finland." He said, "You know," he said, "in Finnish, they have a word which sounds just like Kivio, and it means stone man." What I've discovered since is that the Finnish have a word kivi, which means to sink. And that same word, kivi, is a word in Inuktitut too, and it also means to sink, like a stone. So if you go back far enough in Finnish history, you might find stories about this very same person.
Well, that word itself and the journey of that word around the world, around the Arctic Circle at least, really just sort of speaks to the power of story. And I wanted to wrap up by talking about that. We started talking about your grandmother and the importance of her to pass on those stories to you, the importance for you of passing on those stories to your children and your grandchildren now, and also, you know, hundreds, thousands of people all around the world. Why is story so powerful, do you think?
You know, these stories are not just stories. They teach you all kinds of things about who you are. They teach you morals, you know, by which to live, and the rules about life. And they are very interesting. Like, they're very entertaining. And in Inuit culture, we don't have any hierarchical systems. Like, you know, we don't have upper class, middle class, lower class people. We don't have kings. We don't have queens. We don't have princes. We don't have princesses. We don't even have warriors and chiefs. So everybody is equal. And so in any of our stories, you will never find stories about kings and queens and princesses and all those things. But they are really entertaining because they're kind of travelogues that teach you something, you know. And there has always been a theory that Inuit, along with the whole mass of First Nations people in North and South America, came through the Bering Strait or something like that, you know, a long time ago, like 10,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago. And the theory is there was a land bridge called Beringia, you know, that were the space between Siberia and Alaska was dry land because the ice sucked up all the water, and so it was all dry and Inuit trekked across there. Well, I like to think that we didn't trek across there because, well, it's only 53 miles from Siberia to Alaska, but, you know, we've always been seafaring people. We invented a kayak, and we invented an umiak, which is a kind of a paddling boat, you know, a big boat that's, you know, 20, 25 feet long. And we're, you know, we used to go across, you know, big pieces of big, you know, water. And so I think we have been traveling back and forth to Siberia for years because they're Inuit on the other side. And of course, Inuit in Alaska, and traveling back and forth, we eventually ended up populating the whole, you know, North American Arctic world up there. So that's where the stories, I think, really have a meaning for us.
So I want to wrap up by asking you to tell a very, very short story about a bird that comes into an igloo. You said it was one of your grandmother's favorite stories. Can you tell that to us?
Well, when I was a little kid, you know, we had all these little stories that were always told to us, and they are, I equate them to either lullabies or, you know, like, they're like Mother Goose stories. And, like, there's a little story that goes, Anane kere yuk imak tawyuk. And it's a little story about a little kid and his or her grandmother, and they get left behind all by themselves in their igloo, and then a little bird came, and this little bird, which is a little snow bunting, or what we call kupanua, that breaks the window, it says, palatatatyuk, and then it flies away. And that is a story. It is... just a little rhyme, like anani tali wokimak tell you, kopano de kulumiguigalayak tell you, palatatat you. Just a little simple rhyme.
Well, thank you for sharing it, and thank you for sharing your story for so many years. And you and I are both getting old, and I hope that you never turn to stone and that your heart never stops beating, sir. Thank you very much.
Well, I hope I grow up to be old enough to turn into stone.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye. That was Michael Kusagok from his home in Manitoba. Kirsten Beersley is the Chief Network Services Officer at Food Banks Canada. For decades, food banks have been providing nutritious food to those most in need across Canada. I recently had a chance to talk with her about how farmers help, especially when it comes to fresh food, even over long distances. Here's our chat. Hey, Kirsten, thanks very much for joining us. I want to talk about food banks and fresh food. I know that food banks have been around a long time and an unfortunate necessity right now, and that you distribute a tremendous amount, like 3,000 food banks across Canada are distributing like 28 million pounds of food across Canada. It's sort of astonishing. But over the years, and particularly the last little while, you've been really focusing on fresh food and healthy food, and a lot of that comes from farmers and farmer organizations. So can you talk a little bit about the relationship that you've developed with farmers?
Absolutely. So the food bank network is vast across Canada, as you said. You know, unfortunately, they're still around after 40 years in Canada, but food banks over the last 10 years have really shifted a focus to investing in the infrastructure needed to support fresh food. So that includes, refrigerated trucking, refrigerated vehicles, walk-in fridges and freezers and at food banks. In order to safely secure, accept, and distribute fresh food to clients, and a lot of that comes from the farming community. We've been so supported by farmers at the very sort of hyper-local level, at the provincial producer groups, and nationally with national producer groups. And those are partnerships we really value because we know that's high-quality food that food bank clients are looking for to feed their families.
So when you talk about the hyper-local level, these are individual farmers, egg farmers, beef farmers, dairy farmers who are bringing produce to food banks from their farms?
At the local, very local level, a lot of that would be donated produce. But, you know, folks, no one wants to see food that is healthy and safe go to landfill when it could go to folks in need. And so a lot of food banks have been really supported by their local farming community and receive that food. And then at the provincial, at the producer group level, provincially and nationally, we've worked with producer groups like eggs, like dairy, beef, pork, chicken, all of the major producers, and we've just been really supported as a food banking system to access that food, which of course is high quality food, but also tends to be, you know, more costly for folks who are stretching their dollars.
So let's talk a little bit about access to fresh food. And I want to do it in two contexts. In terms of urban communities where it may be difficult for transportation issues or disability issues for folks to get fresh food. And also the north, because if I look at the amount of food that's being distributed in, say, Ontario, it's about 8 million pounds a year versus the amount of poundage that's being distributed in the territories up north, which is only 41,000 pounds of food. There's a big disparity. Is that primarily a transportation issue, or what's the issue in terms of the north and in terms of urban communities?
Yeah, so just to clarify the numbers a bit, the 28 million is really what Food Banks Canada sources. So throughout the entire food bank system, food banks and provincial groups are sourcing food. So we actually distribute hundreds of millions of pounds as a system annually to folks in need. But yes, absolutely, there are different sort of concerns when you look at urban settings and the north. So in urban areas, there are areas where it's hard to get to a grocery store where they offer fresh. It's also, you know, we look at what else other folks are spending their money on. And in urban settings, a lot of the money that folks receive is going to be spent on housing and the high cost of living in urban settings. And so being able to go to the food bank and access just an array of food that you and I would have in our grocery carts, fresh produce, meats, dairy, eggs, these are all high quality foods. And so the investment that the food banks have made in the last 10 years has really been of benefit to folks, not just in urban settings, but I think some of the challenges when you're in an urban setting make it harder to access that food. And the north is a particular challenge. A lot of it is a logistics challenge. It's hard to get food up into communities that are remote and fly-in, but we've been working with organizations increasingly in the north, working with very generous logistics companies to make sure that we're expanding the reach and the availability of food, especially into the food banking system in the Northern Territories, where we know the issue of food insecurity is really a crisis, actually.
Right. So I look over your strategic plan, and basically your strategic plan, to put it just very succinctly, is to put yourself out of business, to have a set situation where there isn't a need for food banks. So in that context, I wish that you would be out of business very soon. And thank you for taking the time to talk about food banks with us today.
Thank you so much. Yes, our vision is a Canada where no one goes hungry, and we hope that vision comes into reality as soon as possible.
That was Kirsten Beardsley of Food Banks Canada. So here we are at the end of this episode of Harris Smith Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to this podcast on Apple, iTunes, or in your favorite podcast player. And please tell your friends and family. Got feedback? We'd love to hear it. You can email us at letters@harrismithmag.com. That URL, harrismithmag.com, is also where you can order subscriptions online. And you can find Harris Smith Magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. Until next time, for Harris Smith Radio, I'm Wayne McPhail. And also, until next time, remember these four words: make, grow, sustain, share. Tune in for the next episode of Harris Smith Radio.